Good morning, Monument Church. It is my privilege to be preaching to you guys today. Man, I'm excited. What a joy-filled joy-filled Sunday. What an amazing morning where we can just kind of revel in the glory and goodness of God. With that being said, I'm going to change gears here and start us off with a question. And that is, what would you do if you lost everything? Like if you lost your family, your job, your house, your social status, everything all at once, what would you do? What could you do? I mean, I know that many of us have lost at least one of these things in the past, and wrestling with the loss and the pain of one of these things is hard enough, which is why this is a hard question to wrap our mind around. It's one that we kind of shrug off because we don't ever think that we'll lose everything all at once. But actually, this is where we find King David in our story today. So if you guys could open up your Bibles to 2 Samuel 15, verse 2. We're going to read some here, and then we're going to jump around this story a little bit. But it opens up in verse 2. It said, Absalom, who is David's son, just for context, would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. Whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, "What town are you from?" And he would answer, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your claims are valid and proper, but there is no representative of the king to hear you." And Absalom would add, "If only I were appointed judge in the land, then everyone who has a complaint or case could come to me, and I would see that they receive justice." Also, whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, Absalom would reach out his hand, take a hold of him, and kiss him. Absalom behaved this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice, and he stole the hearts of the people of Israel. So this opens up, and Absalom is just being an absolute snake, like right under his dad's nose. He stops people from approaching the king, and he turns them against David. This is actually a very important note, but like a chapter or two before, Absalom is described as the most attractive man in all of Israel. It says he was flawless from head to foot, and he only cut his hair once a year because it got so heavy. So imagine, right? You're going to go bring a complaint to the king's court, and right before you get inside the gate, you see the most handsome, charming guy, like Jim Wilson. Where's Jimmy Jr.? Where are you at? Sorry, Jim. And he's convincing you that nobody inside wants to hear from you. And so you turn around, and you head back home, and you just start being frustrated with King David. How could he not want to hear me? How could he have nobody to hear me? So after 4 years of sowing this bad seed, Absalom convinces David to send him to Hebron because he has to make a sacrifice to the Lord. And as he's in Hebron, he sends out secret messengers to all of the tribes of Israel to stir up rebellion against David, his own father. One day, David is at home and the messenger arrives into Jerusalem and tells David that his own son has crowned himself king over Israel and he has turned all of David's people against him. The messenger then tells David that if he doesn't flee right now, he will die. And so David escapes. So a few things happen as David is fleeing, things that we're not going to get into now, but if you want to read it, it is fascinating stuff in 2 Samuel 15, 16, and 17. But eventually David hears that the only place that is safe for him to be is in the wilderness just beyond the Jordan. And so, betrayed by his own son and his own people that once adored him, with no food, no water, no shelter, no protection, David flees into the desert. Today, I'm not doing a survival guide on how to survive in the desert. We're actually going to take a deeper dive into David's life. And closer than that, we're going to take a deeper dive into David's heart. 1 Samuel 13 describes David as a man after God's own heart. We see this firsthand through 1 and 2 Samuel, and we also see it throughout the Psalms, which is arguably what David is known most for. There are about 150 Psalms, and out of those 150 Psalms, 70 of them are contributed to David, and historians have identified 13 of them that are tied to specific moments in David's life. So here we find David in this movie-like scenario, right? His own son has turned against him. His kingdom has turned against him. He's had to flee his home, flee his family, and now he's in the desert, and he has lost everything. And historians believe that this is when Psalm 63 was written. So if you can turn there now, we will read it all together. It says, a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory. Because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live, and in your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food. My mouth will praise you with joyful lips. When I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night, for you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. But those who seek to destroy my life shall go down into the depths of the earth. They shall be given over to the power of the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. But the king shall rejoice in God, and all who swear by him shall exult, for the mouths of liars will be stopped. Amen. Man, I totally expected a different psalm out of this story in 2 Samuel. Like, I expected one of David's laments, or one where he's like crying out to God for justice against his enemies. Because he has a lot of those, but yet in this place in the desert, we get one of the most beautiful, uplifting, and earnest psalms that David writes. And that is why this psalm and its context makes for the perfect case study of David's heart this morning and his posture towards the Lord. So here's our course of action. We're first gonna look at David's heart, and then we're gonna look at our hearts towards God, and then we're gonna look at how to bridge the gap between the two, because you will find that there's a gap. So the first point is the heart of David. Man, it would actually be an entire other thing if this psalm was written in today's day and age. Like, if it were written in 2023, like if Psalm 63 was a tweet or a Facebook post, where David just knows that people are gonna see this. And so he starts to adjust his words to show that his heart posture is actually better than it is, right? Like, if he hopped on Twitter and he was like, hey guys, just here in the wilderness, just wanted to say how great God is and how much I'm clinging to him. But the amazing thing is that I don't think that David was writing this saying, man, in 2023, on August 27th, people in Montgomery College for Monument Church will be reading my psalm, and I want people to see how my heart is feeling. This is actually just the overflow of his heart. He's just journaling. That's really all this is. And so here are three things that I've picked up from the overflow of David's heart. And as I'm going, let's start to take inventory of our own hearts. Let's start to look at, man, what am I doing well? Where am I lacking? And then let's just ask God that he would just put a finger on our hearts in the areas that he wants to restore and change. So the first thing that I'm pulling out of the overflow of David's heart is actually a very obvious one, because it's the very first line of the psalm. And it says, oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. David has a heart that yearns for the Lord. This is the overflow. He is yearning for the Lord. The NLT of verse 1 says, my whole body longs for you. This is the first thing that David thinks to write. Earnestly, I seek you. I mean, you can bet that the sun is beating down on him. I have these lights on me and I feel a little hot anyway. But the sun is beaming down on him, and he's been walking for who knows how long. And the overflow of his heart leads him to talk to God, to cry out to God in this moment. The important thing to note is that David is actually purposefully comparing his desire for God to the physical desire of wanting something to drink to quench his thirst. He uses this comparison to show that he, even though he needs water to continue to live, his need for God is greater. And God is far more essential to his survival than any physical need. This right here is a heart that yearns for God. I'm not saying that we don't need water to live, but oftentimes we can actually look to the physical things to satisfy us before we cry out to God, before we look to him. So the thing about David's heart, right? This heart after the Lord's own heart, it does not guarantee sinlessness or success for us, but it does mean that as we start to lean into the Lord, our instincts will begin to change. The posture of our heart will begin to change. Our instincts on what we rely on, what we desire, what we look to. Again, it's not every time and every situation, but you'll notice that it starts changing more and more. And we see David's heart in the midst of the desert longing for God. That's point one. David has a heart that yearns for God. My second point is out of verse 8. Simple sentence. Your right hand upholds me. David has a heart that has confidence in the Lord. Historians believe that David is about 66 or 67 years old during Absalom's rebellion. And they also believe that he died at the age of 70 or somewhere around there. And so if you do the math, you find out that David is pretty close to the end of his life here. He only has a few years left to live. And thanks to the Bible, we've actually seen the first 67 years of David's life. And so we know that he has seen the Lord work for 67 years. And therefore, he has confidence that what God has done before, he will do it again. Because he understands God's heart. Guys, he was doing this when he was younger too. We don't need to wait till we're 67 to have confidence in the Lord. For example, when David, one of the first stories that we know about David is David and Goliath, right? David went up to face Goliath and God's right hand upheld him. When Saul put a bounty on David's head, God's right hand upheld him. Even when he messed up, when he committed adultery, when he murdered Uriah, God's right hand still upheld him. And now that he's lost everything, his son has turned his people against him. He is in the desert, but he knows that God's right hand will uphold him. David has experienced success, fame, power, wealth, stability, basically anything that the human heart inherently desires. But he declares in this psalm that he has seen that his steadfast love is better than life. He has made his decision. He's seen what life has to offer, and he has chosen the steadfast love of God because he spent time with the Lord, because he knows the Lord, and he has confidence in the Lord. When you spend time with someone, you have confidence in their abilities. You know what they're able to do and what they're not able to do. You know how to trust them. And David has spent time with the Lord. So David has a heart that yearns for the Lord. He has a heart that has confidence in the Lord. And the third one is that David has a heart that finds joy in the Lord. Verse 7, "For you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy." David is in the desert, right? Need I remind us what's going on? His own son has betrayed him, taken over his kingdom, and he says, "In the shadow of your wings, I will sing for joy." He says, "My mouth will praise you with joyful lips." I mean, I feel like in the slightest inconvenience in my life, my reaction is doom. Like I get a flat tire and I'm like, come on, why? I'm never joyful about it. I'd say, "Today of all days." And I would say that any day. And so maybe David is in this place of, "Oh God, I will praise you because you're great and I love to praise you." Maybe. But maybe, and I feel like this is a little more likely, he's in one of those places, and I think we can all resonate with this, where he's just saying, "I really do not feel like worshiping right now." We're saying, "I really don't feel like thinking about God or talking to him." I mean, how many of us have been there? I have constantly. How many of us were there this morning, like 10 a.m. is too early? But David is able to remind himself. He's able to pull himself up and find joy in the Lord. And he's able to say, because your steadfast love is better than life, so my lips will praise you. I mean, if he can convince himself to open up his parched, chapped lips, so can we. Brian and Lucinda, I think of you guys and your whole family, just when it comes to a heart that finds joy in the Lord. I mean, we've only known each other for not long, and Brian was coming to our prayer meetings, and so I'd see him about once a month, and I don't mean that you guys greet me with a smile every time. That's not what I mean by you guys find joy in the Lord. I mean that you guys, when I talk to you, you just joy pours out of you guys. When you pray, we can tell that you guys have found joy in the Lord amidst your trials. And now we get to have joy amidst the miracle, right? But you guys are such a helpful example for all of us. So thank you guys for the way that you guys have walked that out. Yeah, Lord, give us a heart after yours, please. I can confess that a heart that yearns, a heart that has confidence in the Lord, and a heart that finds joy in the Lord is just not often the posture of my heart. Like, I feel like I do well with each of these heart responses briefly and at different times. And I feel like that's true for most of us. But posture, right, as it pertains to the body, is how we hold ourselves when we stand or when we sit. Posture is kind of like a habit. So if I were to sit down right now, you guys would be able to see that my habit for posture is slouching. I would sit down. I would just revert to what I've been doing. Even standing up straight like this right now is not normal for me. I'll have moments of when I'm like, oh shoot, I should have good posture right now. And my back will be straight and you'll see my chest high. But it's actually not my common state. And that's the same thing with my heart. I'll have moments where I'm yearning for the Lord. I'll have moments where I'm depending on the Lord, or moments where I'm finding joy in him, but it's not my default setting. And so that's the second thing that I want to look at today, common postures of the human heart. I want to look at three default settings, if you will. And these are not all of them, because there are too many that our broken, sinful hearts fall into. But there are three that I've pulled from Psalm 63, because as we continue to mind the words of David in Psalm 63, we just looked at what he's saying. And now I want to look at the opposite of that. Just because sometimes when we find the opposite characteristics of God's heart, we will often find the characteristics of a broken, sinful human heart. So let's look at verse 1 again. I just want to start us off with, again, what a phrase. Oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. What is a heart that doesn't earnestly seek God? What is a heart that at its core doesn't really feel the need for God? And that will be a complacent heart. It's a heart that knows the truth but doesn't always abide by it. A heart that feels as though it's fine all on its own. Right? I found an article by Indeed at the job finding website, and they were warning about complacency in the workplace. And they were like, if you find any signs of this in the way that you work, like, you need to change something around now, because it is not a good sign. And so this is their list for signs of complacency at work. It says this, it says, disengagement, lack of investment in yourself or others, loss of passion for your work, shortcuts, minimal initiative or none at all, neglecting tasks and following carelessness. Now, this is for the workplace, right? And you'd think that these two things have nothing in common, but actually, this does apply to our heart posture towards God. Again, as we are searching our hearts for what we're missing, I want us to look in our hearts and see, do any of these apply to us? Have you noticed disengagement in your relationship with God? Have you noticed a lack of investment in yourself, in your relationship with God? Have you lost the passion to be in his word, to get to know him? Have you lost interest in what he has for you? Have you lost all initiative to meet with him, to sit at his feet, and to know him? I mean, these could be signs of a complacent heart, one that doesn't yearn for God. And there could be so many reasons that this is our heart posture. And I feel like this is my heart posture. This is my heart's default setting. Drifting by, feeling fine without seeking God daily. And this is why we need to constantly be checking our hearts for the sake of realignment. I'm sure David was tempted to give up. I'm sure he was tempted to not want to seek God earnestly. But he didn't because he was aligned with God's heart. He was aligned to the will of God. So that's the first thing. The first heart posture is a complacent heart. The second opposite that I want to pull out of is out of verse 5. It says, "My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food." This is a pretty easy one to find the opposite of. But the opposite of a satisfied heart is an unsatisfied heart. David looks no further than God for joy and satisfaction. He even writes elsewhere in Psalm 34, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good." He is physically starving, and yet he declares that his soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food. The unsatisfied heart is a heart that is looking for satisfaction in the wrong places. It is so, so easy to be distracted from God. It is so easy to be distracted from what he has for us, especially with the enemy constantly whispering in our ears the things that are going to fulfill the hole in our hearts. No wonder we turn so easily to sin. No wonder we turn to things like money, relationships, work, or the pursuit of our goals. And then we sprint at these things, hoping that they will fill the hole. And these few things that I mentioned, they're good things. But if they are the source of our satisfaction, then we have turned that into the thing that we worship. And then it becomes sinful. The second you remove God from the throne on your heart and put one of these other things in there, that is when it becomes sinful. This is human nature. I mean, it is so easy to search for satisfaction with other things. I wonder what David's doing when he's in the desert. Like, how easy would it have been for him to just go and search for food? Like, anywhere. I would be so consumed by finding water, finding food, finding a place to sleep. And yet his heart is one that is positioned to be satisfied by God alone. So that is the second common heart posture, the second default heart posture. We have a complacent heart, an unsatisfied heart. And the third one, it's from verse 6, and it says, "I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night." Another easy one to guess what the opposite of remembering is. It is forgetting. A forgetful heart. I'm reminded of the Israelites in Exodus. God leads them out of captivity from Egypt. He leads them through the sea, which he parted. They walk on dry land. And immediately after God does this amazing work, they complain. Like, immediately, they turn against Moses and they say, "What are we going to drink?" And immediately God provides water. And then the next chapter, they go, "What are we going to eat now?" And they start complaining and they turn against Moses. And God provides manna from heaven. And then they forget. And this cycle of them complaining and God providing continues, but they keep forgetting the power of God. They keep forgetting who he is. And so when the people of Israel finally enter the promised land, God instructs them to build a memorial in the Jordan so that they would not forget. And they continue to forget. I'm so tempted every time I read this to just be so frustrated with the Israelites. I'm like, guys, what are you doing? How do you forget that God threw bread from heaven so that you could eat? How do you forget that he led you out of captivity into freedom by an impossible thing, by parting the Red Sea? I get so frustrated. And then I realize that I am the Israelites. And I realize that how many times am I anxious or worried because I forget that God provides and I forget that God has provided? I mean, how many times am I filled with guilt or shame or condemnation because I forget about the work that Jesus did on the cross? I forget to remember God. I get so distracted by life that I forget to meditate on his goodness. And yet David has this heart posture of remembrance. I think I have so much going on, and then I look at David, who has lost everything. He's here in the desert. He's processing everything that's happening. And here he is, remembering the goodness of God. He's meditating on him in the watches of the night. So those are the three default heart postures for us. A complacent heart, an unsatisfied heart, and a forgetful heart. So now it feels like there's this ginormous gap between where David is and where our default settings are. And sometimes I can look at it and I'm like, I don't really feel like getting into that because it feels too wide. But just like Travis said last week, we're not here for platitudes. We're not here to give quick fixes to bigger heart issues. We're here seeking after God's heart. Amen. To know his heart more, to have a heart after his own heart. So how do we do this? We replicate what David is doing in this psalm. And again, we don't need to look elsewhere to see how to do this. We don't need to look up an article on three steps to have a heart after God's own heart. It's right here. It's right here in Psalm 63. So the first thing that we see David doing, and he does this all over the Psalms, just literally flip to one and I'm sure you'll find it. He talks to his soul. He reminds his soul. You'll see him all the time. He says, "Bless the Lord, O my soul. All that is within me, bless his holy name." Or he says, "Oh my soul, why are you downcast within me?" He's constantly talking to his soul. And in this psalm, we see him reminding himself of what the Lord has done, reminding himself that it is worth it. He says, "Because your steadfast love is better than life, so my lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live." I have found this helpful, this habit of talking to my soul so helpful. Whenever I feel hopeless or anxious or angry or frustrated or whatever it is, if I can remember, I just talk to myself. I just say, "Oh my soul, why are you downcast within me?" Or, "Oh my soul, worship the Creator." I remind my soul who it is dealing with. I remind it that it's actually not in my hands, it's in the hands of the Creator of the universe. And my soul starts to listen. It doesn't magically fix things, but it helps put everything into perspective. Our hearts and our minds will start to shift. Speak to your soul. The second thing is, and this one might seem a little obvious, but David acknowledges reality. You're like, okay, I acknowledge reality all the time. How is this helpful? We really do have a tendency to either minimize our situations and not feel our feelings and just shove it off to the side, or we make our situation so big in our eyes that it is just absolutely suffocating and it's crippling and we let our feelings control us. But David shows us a really good balance, right? He sees his situation. He says, "In this dry and weary land where there is no water," he acknowledges his need for a rescuer.